When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Hey everyone, welcome to Fat Mascara. This is Jen. Jess is still feeling under the weather, so she'll be with us for the interview. We recorded that last week, but it's just me to introduce you to our amazing guest. I have to say, this is a Fat Mascara first. We've never had a philosopher on the show before. So Professor Heather Widows, she's a philosopher, obviously I just said so, specializing in applied ethics. She received her PhD from New College at the University of Edinburgh. And today she is the, okay, let me make sure I get this right. John Ferguson Professor of Global Ethics and the Deputy Pro Vice Chancellor Research Impact at University of Birmingham. Okay, Heather, I hope I did that right. She's the author of 4 books, including the 2018 book, Perfect Me, Beauty as an Ethical Ideal. Now, this is how I was first introduced to her work. I read the book. I realized I didn't know anything about philosophy. I think I understood most of her arguments. And I was like, maybe I should reach out and see if I can learn more. And she was so willing to come on the show. So, here's a little bit more about what she studies and what she does. In 2019, she launched a social media campaign to end body shaming at the annual Global Ethics Conference at the University of Birmingham. And her work in bioethics and on looks-based discrimination, or lookism, which we'll talk about her with, has informed public policy debates and working groups within the UK Parliament. So in this interview, we get a great background first into what philosophy and ethics are. Apologies to those of you that already work in those fields and know, but it's new to me. Jess, I know, has taken a philosophy course, but like we still wanted to get a basis of understanding before we talk to her. And then we talk about looks-based discrimination. And this is the part I love. There's practical uses for her research, and she explains them to us. Honestly, it reframed the entire way I think about how we talk about others' looks, and it gave me a really good understanding of the pervasiveness of looks-based discrimination and how we should be more aware of it. It's truly eye-opening. I think it will change the way you think about the world, the way you think about yourself and others and your looks. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as both Jess and I did, and here it is. Okay, Professor Heather Widows, welcome to Fat Mascara.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to just keep calling you Professor. Because,
please call me Heather.
but that is what you are, and you're a philosopher. And so we're going to have a great discussion about beauty ethics, beauty ideals. But before we get into that, I have to say you are the first philosopher we have ever had on our podcast, and we've been doing this a while. So I think it might be helpful, at least for me, someone who hasn't studied philosophy, for you to explain
what a philosopher does. What do you do?
The easiest answer that I can give to that is the answer that my husband, who's a historian, gave to my daughter when she was very little. And he said, Daddy tells stories about how the world used to be. And Mummy's a philosopher. She tells stories about how the world should be. So that's kind of how to think of it. What should we be doing? So as a moral philosopher, I think about values. I think about what human beings are, what we could be, how we should arrange society to bring out our best, to make us flourish, how we can enable human beings to live their best and fullest possible lives.
I love that. And obviously you teach students as well, and you've written books, and we'll get into that. But I've noticed, and the reason we're having you on the show is because you focused some of your research and some of your philosophizing, I don't even know if that's a verb, on beauty ideals and how society treats the concept of human beauty. So I'm curious what even drew you to this topic. I imagine your professors, when you were studying, were like, okay. What's going on here?
Well, I didn't turn to beauty, I have to be honest, until I was a full and very established professor. Because you're right, I would have got some very strange looks. So I started off my career as a global ethicist. So most of my work in the first 10, 15 years of my career was all around much more traditional ethical issues. So, you know, women's rights, genetic justice, climate change, all the things where you think we should be thinking about how to respond with our values and our systems of governments and what should we do? How do we, you know, protect rights and the environment and all of the issues that you might think of when you think ethics? And gradually I began to think there's something really weird going on with beauty, with visual culture, and that this is an issue of global justice too. So beauty ideals are shaping what human beings can be and do, just as much as some of our inequality might be and other very standard issues in global justice and ethics. So actually, I just began to rethink beauty as an issue of global justice.
But I got to say, like, what do you mean? What is a beauty ideal? What does that actually mean? Because I never took a philosophy class. Actually, I did, but then I dropped out after a week. Sorry. True story.
Oh, no.
Rutgers University.
It was that bad. So an ethical ideal is just really quite simple. It's
or the beauty ideal. The beauty ideal.
Well, if I'm talking about the beauty ideal, I'm talking about it as an ethical ideal. So to understand the beauty ideal, you have to understand what an ethical ideal is. And an ethical ideal is just simply the stuff we value, we judge ourselves on. If we do it right, we think we're succeeding. If we don't do it right, we think we're failing. And when I talk about the beauty ideal becoming an ethical ideal, what I mean is that we're valuing ourselves by our bodies, by how we look. We think if we get our body right, we'll get our life right. We'll have a flourishing, a happy life. If we get our body wrong, then everything else will go wrong. And when I'm teaching students, I talk about things like, well, look at our New Year's resolutions, right? Nearly all of those nearly are about the body. We lose weight, we exercise. And this is what we think will give us a better self and a better life. And if you compare that to the ideals we used to have, they were much more about our character. I'm going to be kinder. I'm going to be a better mum. There's this lovely quote I have from a teenage girl's diary. And I'm going to get the year wrong, but it's something like 1792 or something, on, you know, 1892, I'm very wrong, but a long time ago, but not so long we don't forget it, where she says, oh, I resolve to be better. I resolve to think before I speak. I resolve to be more caring and more self-contained, right? So the aspiration for a good self that would then deliver the goods of the good life was to have this kind of more thoughtful, more caring character. And now we seem to think that actually, if we can just get our bodies right, then we'll have all those things, all the goods of the good life that we used to think came through having a better self. So it's a really interesting shift. Ourselves have almost become our bodies. And this is really different from what we used to value and care about.
When did that switch happen?
So it's kind of in progress. And it's almost crept up on us. The fact that when you talk about that, people go, oh, yeah, of course, that's true. But at no point did we suddenly notice there was a change happening. It happened around us almost incrementally. So it's very much in progress, and it's not like it's one or the other. We still do some of both, but certainly we've moved to a place where how we look and how we appear is something we judge ourselves and others on.
But would you peg it to, like, you know, I feel like in the 50s, I feel, I'm no historian, but I feel like women were dieting and doing all of that. So when was it, you know, when like magazines came around or?
Not just in the 50s, but all the way back in time, right? We've never thought that appearance doesn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. But it's very rarely been the thing that we judge ourselves on. And also it's often been for a short period of time and only certain people and only for a short period of time rather than this ongoing thing. So one of the arguments I'm making Perfect Me is I track that the requirement to do body work, to have this kind of perfect or more normalized body has extended. It extends over types of people. So it's not just, you know, young women, it's all women, and it starts really young and it goes almost into old age, as you know, 30s, yeah. The new 40 or whatever else. And you're supposed to be bikini ready when you're 70 and you're supposed to have a, you know, naked pregnancy shot with that really cute little pregnancy bump, because even when you're pregnant, you're supposed to show your worth by having the right pregnancy. So the body's gone from something that, yes, of course, we've always cared about appearance in some sense, to something that is a barometer of almost all of the things we do. So you're a good mum if you get that bikini body back, you know, after the pregnancy, as opposed to the other thing. So it really interesting is the way that celebrities present. So if you go back to some of the 80s magazines, you know, when you're interviewing that Hollywood actress, you'd be having her in the magazine, you know, with her nice house and pool, but you'd also have the husband there and the perfect kids, because the status is partly from the relationship. Now, even when we're talking about being a good mum, you're proving it by, you know, popping back into your pre-pregnancy body within a matter of weeks, because somehow that's showing that you're delivering.
Right.
Is it just, you're mentioning women a lot. Is it just for women that you are studying this and proposing this, or?
So in Perfect Me, I do track the beauty ideal for women, and there are four features: thinness in some form, so usually with curves and increasingly very pronounced curves. And there's interesting things going on there about how cosmetic surgery plays into the changing shapes of beauty ideals. Firmness, smoothness, and youth. So the four features that track for women are those four, and those are the ones that I track through Perfect Me, through all kinds of different measures. Now, I looked at global ideals for men, and the only feature that globally tracks as yet for men is tallness. So it's certainly...
Are you serious?
Oh, yes. I am.
Skin doesn't matter?
Not in that there's a uniform, only this works. So across the beauty ideals, it moves in one way. So there's some areas where it's quite similar. So right, if you think about that kind of muscled up hunk, that's quite similar to the beauty firm ideal, right? Yeah. It's firm, yeah. It's not fat, but it's firm and smooth and young, big, but definitely not fat. But then it's also possible to have lots of other ideals in other places. There are some places where, you know, we're still really into bearded men. In some places, we're into smooth men. In some places, you're allowed to have the dad bod. And, you know, it's much, much less obvious that there's one range coming in. Whereas in women's ideals, it is much, much more globally the case. But men are worrying more. One of the reasons we're panicking is that men are getting...
I wanted you to say something like that. Yeah. Just like, yeah. I'm curious, you mentioned global. So clearly, I remember studying like back in the day, like different cultures would appreciate different things in beauty ideals. Like some cultures would appreciate a curvier body, some wouldn't. Are you saying that that sort of blended together and that around the world you're finding the same ideals?
Right. So I'm finding that the ideals track in the same direction. So in places where we used to value bigger figures, we're now moving towards valuing underweight figures. So South Africa is a good example. In the most recent studies, it's underweight figures that are now valued when it didn't used to be. So so I'm not arguing that there's this one single thing, right? You don't all have to look like Barbie, but the trends are moving in the same direction, and the range that you're allowed to be gets narrower and narrower. So, you know, the thinness with curves becomes something that it manifests slightly differently in different places, but the drive to thinness is now global. The focus on lighter, more homogeneous skin tones. So we have this global mean is the kind of coffee coloured bronze or gold skin. So, and you trade features off against each other. So some features are more important in one place or another, but it's the case that globally the trends are going in the same direction towards this thin with curves, smooth, firm and young.
And I imagine this is all based on like research and surveys of the population, not just you looking at pictures and being like, I think this is what everybody's doing.
So I'm a philosopher, right? So I don't do empirical research, but what I do is what you'd kind of talk about if you wanted to use terminology like meta-analysis. So I look at eating disorders across the world. I look at surgery trends across the world. I look at the sociological ethnographic studies of what people say they do. I look at the psychological studies about body image anxiety. So I do that kind of across the whole, what's going on. So the example I just gave you of South African is a study done by a sociologist, and I take hundreds of studies and track the trends.
Do you think this is because of, you know, social media and just the world being able to see all of the same images at the same time? Kind of the shrinking of our, like, you know, visual language?
The shrinking of the global culture, that's for sure one of the drivers, that we do sort of all live in the same Instagram world and we're kind of comparing ourselves across cultures. So psychologists would argue that our peer comparison group has gone from, you know, your little village where, you know, you may have been, you know, not the best nor the worst in the class, you know, and you sort of, you know, but hey, that's it. Yeah. And very soon it matters less. Beauty matters less when you get to know people more, right? And now suddenly we're in a world where appearance matters an awful lot and you don't know people very well. It's all much more transitory. So that bit of your identity and of how you judge people kind of gets bigger. So that's one factor. Another is that kind of weird celebrity thing that I talked about before, that it's your body that's telling you other things about who you are. So the body that's in control is telling you that you're a capable businesswoman, that you're an organized mum, all those other things that you might have signaled in a different way. And that's kind of a strange way that consumption is playing out, where instead of buying the right car or the right house or the it bag, we're buying the body. So, you know, it's you're buying the shape of the body to say something about who you are. And that's a strange shift. Another bit is just that we can do it. You know, so if I'm teaching, I talk about Elizabeth I, because she was apparently very vain and she wanted to look, you know, wrinkle-free. So she had a habit, historians tell us, of wearing a lot of white lead on her face, which actually didn't do her much good in the long term, and wearing big ruffs around her neck to hide her aging, wrinkly neck. So there wasn't a lot she could do. Right now, the list is endless. You could spend morning, noon and night doing everything from your daily lotions and potions that are full of all your resurfacing and wrinkly raising cream to injectables to surgery, and it all becomes more and more normal. And that's the thing about a global ideal that's not true of local ideals. When it becomes global, then the work involved gradually becomes invisible. So if it's a local ideal, then it's obviously about beauty. It's obviously work. And then as soon as it becomes a global ideal, it starts to be invisible. So if you think about some really extreme beauty ideals, like the Chinese bound foot or Victorians wearing corsets, right? They were really demanding. They were really hard on your body. But they were always about beauty because they were always only ever local. So that aristocratic Chinese woman with that tiny lotus foot, she might have believed it was beautiful. She might have believed it was desirable, even perfect, but she could never have believed it was normal or natural. And as we have a global ideal, things gradually become normalized and naturalized. So the example I constantly go back to, because I love it, is body hair removal. Right, that hairless, smooth body is increasingly becoming seen as a natural body, a hygiene practice, rather than an adornment practice that's actually really quite demanding. So the bodywork gets hidden and beauty practices become recast as health or hygiene practices. And that way the kind of demands rise without us noticing, in a way that couldn't have happened when it wasn't a global ideal.
Yeah. So as it rises to first like a health and hygiene ideal, and then if you continued on that spectrum, I imagine is where you start to get into, okay, now it's like a moral thing and an ethical thing. Like at what point do you get to, is this where the guilt comes in? I guess is what I'm about to ask. Like, if I haven't done it, am I a bad person? Like, I'm looking at my picture and I still have pimples on my photo and I feel like I'm a bad person. Look at the villains in like a Disney movie. They always put a couple warts on the villain. You know what I mean? Like, at what point do we get to that crossover, or are you saying we're there?
I think in many instances we're there. Certainly, we're now at the point where body shame is almost defining of very many people a lot of the time. So if you look at body image anxiety, very many young women and girls and increasingly young boys will not do all kinds of things for fear of being shamed about how they look. And, you know, surveys will tell us from things like speaking up in class to doing exercise to even going out of the house. Like, we all know what a bad hair day is, right? The fact that we know what a bad hair day is, that tells you something about
even the
how
word bad and good. It's like, it's not like pretty and not pretty, it's bad and good.
And it's all over. Morality is all over beauty talk. You know, you have failed when you've let yourself go. You know, you'll deserve it, you're worth it. These are just moral judgment terms, and it's everywhere in beauty.
Do you remember in the first Sex and the City movie when they're in Mexico and Miranda comes out in her swimsuit and her pubic hair is like outside of her bathing suit, and they close up and it's like, rawr, rawr. And Samantha makes this really funny joke and it's just like, oh my God, like, blah, blah, blah. But then it becomes a serious moment and Miranda, it's sad. Miranda gets upset and she was like, it's like, you realize she's wounded. Miranda's like, so you think that, you know, Steve left me because I like let myself go. Like, you know, like basically,
yeah,
he cheated on her because she like stopped shaving her or waxing her, you know, badge.
So right. It could, body shaming cuts so deeply, and yet we don't take it seriously. We think it's funny or we think it's normal. And yet actually the shame involved in you know, fat shaming is the most obvious example, but we do it about body hair, we increasingly do it about wrinkles. Is that like what you're describing? Yeah. Is the little red circles in the magazines that show, you know, the cellulite or the failure. And the implication, right, is not that, oh God, right, why are we calling this out? The implication is you should do better, you know, sort your body out. That's your fault.
And it's women who do it to each other. I thought it was like a very kind of like clever edit, you know, because it's like it's just how women have put these expectations on each other, and we do things like first. Do we do them for ourselves? Do we do it for men? Do we do it for women? Do we do it for fashion? Like, why do we do these things? And she was like a tired mom. You know, it was just so many things at once.
The judging is ubiquitous and universal. So, yeah. I mean, we have a project where people upload their body shaming stories, and it's done by all kinds of people and all kinds of reasons, by your mum, your grandma, men, women, sometimes even for good intentions. It's extraordinary. And yet all it does is induce shame and guilt. Completely, completely not something we should be doing.
You talk in your book about like the as we know we can do more, like all these ways to fix ourselves if we want to, we should. You also talk about how the ethics works. But I'm worried now as I'm talking to you about like all these products out there. I've noticed in the last maybe 5 years of doing my job, the number of products available to help me remove hair or not, or to get wrinkles or not, just the sheer volume of them has increased exponentially. Does that work into your hypothesis that like, yeah, because the more you see the things that are fixing, the more you think you need to be fixed?
So it's seen as a recession-proof market because we care about it so much. So I can't remember the exact number, but it used to be the case, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, that most makeup routines were 8 steps, and now they're like in the 20-something steps. And that's just the makeup before you get to the various layerings of serums and creams and other products. So that, I mean, that's a little bit of the kind of, you know, capitalism at work, right? There is an unending ability to sell us stuff, but it's not the only reason. It's just one piece of the puzzle. So if what we valued was great intellect, right, we'd all be out there buying mind-enhancing drugs and having various, you know, implants in our brains, right? We wouldn't be worrying about whether our teeth are straight and our pores are small. Like small pores, this is another great one, right? Small pores, that was not a thing when I was growing up. It really wasn't. It definitely wasn't when my mother was growing up. My daughter is now 13. Oh my God. Large pores are a thing, right? This is like classic.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Classic capitalism. You create a problem and then you sell people something to fix it.
Well, right. So there's the chicken and the egg thing there, though, right?
Right. But again, we only value we only buy it because what we value is the smooth, perfect skin, right? And there you can also see the tech at work, because one of the reasons we value the smooth skin is we've got used to looking at skin on screens where it's never, right? We know it's never real skin. It's not the same as sitting across a dinner table at somebody. It's filtered, it's touched up, or it's just the way that screens change how one looks. And yet we aspire to Instagram perfect skin, even though we know it's not actually real. All right, we know that even the most doctored celebrity doesn't actually look like that when she's walking down the street. And at the same time, we have those magazines. But there's something about visual culture that even though we know it, it still feeds our pictures of how we should look, our imaginings of our perfect self.
I just keep thinking, going back in history, to like whoever invented the first mirror, like she was just like, whoever that person was, like that set off a whole trajectory.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Listen, there are so many skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, and you know I will try most of them. But how do you know your products are actually working? Some research to back up the claims. That's why Jess and I are all about Ritual. They created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted a clinical study to take the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual's Hyacera is now a part of my skincare routine, and I got in the habit of taking it every day by putting the cute little purple jar right next to my sunscreen. It looks nice on my vanity, and let's be honest, I love that. But once I stuck with the habit, I really noticed a difference in my skin. I am not the only one. In a clinical study, taking Hyacera for 90 days led to a 3.6-time reduction in crow's feet wrinkles as compared to placebo. And it led to a 2.9 increase in skin smoothness. I also like that they're easy to swallow. The capsules sort of taste like vanilla. They're not all weird and fishy like some other supplements. Plus, Ritual is a certified B Corp, something we learned about on a recent episode. And all their supplements, including the Daily Protein and their Sleep Bio Series Melatonin Supplement, are vegan, gluten-free, and made traceable. Do what Jess and I did. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/mascara. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/mascara for 25% off.
So, Heather, you talked about some of the downsides of becoming an ethical ideal and what happens is obviously you have a 13-year-old daughter. I feel like you're like front lines of this right now. Are there any upsides before we get back into what we can do to fix it? Like, is there anything that's like, why would this come about in a society if there wasn't some positive to it? I'm not saying I believe there is. I'm just curious to, I'm philosophizing with you.
Yeah, no, that's what we should do, right? That's exactly what we should do. Think about what on earth is going on and why. And yeah, you're absolutely right. There are actually lots of positives. And one of the things that frustrates me is people often sit on either side of this debate. They say, oh no, it's all great. It's all choice. It's all self-expression. Or they sit on the other side and go, no, it's all terrible. It's all evil. It's all dominance. And actually the truth is, right, the truth is in the middle, right? If we keep going the way we're going, yes, we're going for more demanding and harder to live with. But if we don't, if we think about the positive aspects of this, there are creative aspects of this. It is important that we think of ourselves as bodies and not just minds or something. So philosophers used to just think about the mind and they used to talk about the ghost in the machine. Right, that's no good, right? We spend a lot of our lives as babies or as elderly dependent people, right? We need to recognize that we're partly bodies. Bodies fail, bodies have needs. We have to think about our embodied being. Sometimes the only touch that you will get as an adult that is not a health touch or a sexual touch is the beauty touch. We've actually created a whole world where we legitimize really important social touching in the beauty context. I use the example of somebody in an old people's home where maybe that weekly hairdresser is the only time they get a touch that is caressing and not perfunctory or for health reasons. There's all kinds of bonding practices that we've created around beauty, especially women, but from, you know, shopping to sharing each other's clothes to doing makeup together. Now, of course, they're not necessary to beauty, right? We could have some other reason that we did it, but at the moment they are beauty in our society. So we don't want to, you know, pretend that those aren't really positive and enriching aspects of beauty culture. So I think it's not about criticizing it all. It's about trying to pick the creative and life-giving bits of it and the celebratory bits, and to push back against the dominating and demanding bits.
Yeah. Just thinking then back to the dominating and negative sides, do you see the standard of beauty changing even further as we go further down this path? Like, I can picture right now that beauty ideal you described earlier. But in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, is that going to be like a robot? Like, what would happen to our beauty ideal? Do you know what I mean?
I think you might be onto something there. We're definitely moving to more of a plastic perfection. You know, what people aspire to is increasingly this kind of, you know, almost plastic Barbie-ish kind of face and body. And interestingly, there's this movement where people are starting to take, they're not taking pictures of celebrities to the cosmetic surgeon. They're kind of taking their best doctored selfie. So the self that they want to create is their own kind of, like, so obviously that's just like, you know, some anecdotal stuff from some surgeons of what's been going on, especially post-pandemic when people have been sitting on Zoom and then going, oh, I need to fix all this. But, you know, I like this doctored selfie. It's a really interesting trend. But yeah, I think we will, right? We've normalized the removal of body hair. In many places, we've normalized all kinds of injectables, not as something you do when you've got wrinkles and you're old, but as something that you do beforehand to prevent you ever getting them. So to introduce having routine, relatively invasive body work in the same way as we go to the hairdresser. And in some countries, so thinking about, you know, South Korea or Lebanon or Brazil, we've already routinized cosmetic surgery as a very normal part of life. And if the trends keep going in the same way, and if the ideal remains, you know, thin with ever exaggerated curves, right, that will mean more intervention and more body work, because you cannot have a tiny thin waist and a huge luxurious backside without some kind of intervention or some body work.
But do you think, like, I mean, there's definitely a group of people, like, you know, certainly a lot of Gen Z is rebelling against this idea of hyper perfection, sort of, you know, the Instagram aesthetic. You know, they're showing, like, you know, unfiltered skin. You know, it would be completely unheard of to have, you know, underarm hair and leg hair at a pool party when I was younger. But now there's, I'm sure, people even in your daughter's class, you know, who maybe are rejecting that they need to shave because as like a rite of passage. So while I don't think that's the majority, it's definitely something that didn't exist when I was 13 and, you know, an adolescent. Do you think that they could possibly upend or like take a good swing at the beauty ideal?
I sort of hope they could, but I'm a little bit cynical about how much local resistance does, especially when it's often Instagrammed, right? So that so often on the body positive movements of different sorts, so whether it's body hair or whether it's fat acceptance, what you'll often find, and this might be the next piece of work, is that what is critiqued is only one of those four aspects of the ideal. So on the Janya Hairy campaigns, I don't know if you saw that, mm-hmm. you'd get lots of pictures of what were incredibly usually conforming women. So they were thinnish, smoothish, youngish, with body hair. Yeah, and just like on a lot of the fat acceptance campaigns, you'll get incredibly beautiful, bigger women, but often very made up in quite stereotypical ways. And even in those
with smooth skin, firm,
yeah. And even in 1950s pinup poses. So it's actually quite rare to see real diversity that's really pushing back. And also, even when it is, it's always about the body. Like, these are not. So, you know, all of these campaigns still focus on the body. It's very hard to find things that think about things that other features that are not simply how one looks. So it's on. There's a strange thing that we haven't come to terms with in the visual culture about how we use the pressure of images to do real diversity. So often I was talking recently, I won't tell you which magazine, there's somebody from one of the magazines was trying to do diversity and asking me exactly these things, like, how do we do diversity in fashion that pushes back? I'm like, well, when you're doing your fashion shoot, have a look at your models and make sure that you haven't just got one old one, but who's basically really slim and quite good looking, and one bigger one, right? Make sure you've got proper diversity where we're seeing all kinds of body shapes, hairlessness, disability, old features, and together, and in a way that you have presented them that they're as beautiful. So it's much easier to have body hair, for instance, when you are relatively young than when you are much older and fatter and, going to an event. So there's a context there. So They're cherry picking, and also often they're young enough to get away with it.
Like, it's easy to look like, you can be, like, I'm trying to think of who would be, like, you can be Cara Delevingne and have a little armpit hair.
Right.
That's not bravery.
It's kind of like, it's good that it recognizes that body hair is natural again, and it's got its heart in the right place. Whether those kind of things are going to be enough to really do anything to challenge this increasingly dominant beauty ideal, I don't know. And whether we are going to stop shaming for people. And right, if we were really challenging it out, we wouldn't even be commenting on it, right? Because we'd have made it normal. The diversity would be normal. The fact that
we wouldn't have to be, look at us being diverse.
Exactly. Yeah. The fact we have to champion it, it means that it's so strong. So this is why I always focus not on what individuals do, right? I don't think we're really challenging it effectively. We've been talking for 25 years, you know, about resisting the beauty ideal. You know, when Naomi Wolf wrote her book, right, that was all about, oh God, this is awful, let's resist it, women push back, right? As collectively, women globally did not push back, and it's easier to push back the more privileged position you are, the more easy it is not to conform. It's much harder not to conform if you're, you know, working in your local bar or supermarket and that's the policy and that's your livelihood and you're doing three jobs. Not to wear makeup when it's expected is much harder. If you look at the poorest places in the world, places where skin lightening cream is sold in much of sub-Saharan Africa, skin lightening cream that's actually been through Latin America. So it's actually much more dangerous because the chemicals have become more intense and people have lost the instructions, which say don't go out in the sun. So it's desperately damaging. You find that actually it's much harder. So I'm really resistant to those messages, not because I don't think they've got their hearts in the right place, but for 25 years, we've been telling women, don't do this. The more money we've had, the more power we've had, the more we've won other feminist agendas on education and marriage, the more we've done beauty. So I think we should just stop thinking about resistance as what we do and start thinking about it as culture change, because then we'll be less critical of each other. When we think about resistance as what we do, we actually start watching bodies more. We spend more time looking at other women. Oh, has she had work done? Is she growing her body hair? Is she wearing makeup?
Yeah.
And that just makes us beat up on each other. So if we don't think about what we should do or not do and actually think about where can we push back on the culture change, maybe we'll work together and be less critical of ourselves and each other.
Yeah. And it definitely, I love what you said about taking a place of privilege, because I'm just thinking if you're trying to get a job at a supermarket or whatever it is, you don't have the privilege to come in not being beauty standards, not having like put like some cream on your face and shaved your hair and at least tried to look presentable, because it's your livelihood. You just need to make money. So I guess being in a place of privilege like I am, I'm like, okay, let's do this, Heather. So when that brings me to this point, now we're very aware, or everybody is, of these ideals. Like, has it changed how you think about yourself and your grooming? Like, as much as you study it and you're aware that these are there, like, how do you fight against this happening?
So I come back just to my last point, is I absolutely refuse to think about what individuals do or don't do. So in terms of myself, I'm just kinder to myself. I don't have that split feminist personality anymore of, oh my goodness, I feel like, you know, I should be looking a certain way, but oh no, that's not being feminist. I just now think that's just bullshit. Right, it's just a way to stop us addressing this. So I'm just much kinder to myself, and I think I'm therefore much kinder to everybody else, because I just think the last thing that we should ever do on this is focus on what we do or don't do.
Yeah, which goes into what you're saying, which is the whole moral thing, which is what we want to get away from. You also talked about the concept of lookism, and can you just explain what that is and how prevalent that is?
Right. Of course. Thank you for asking. So lookism is just appearance discrimination. So just like sexism is discrimination on grounds of gender and racism is discrimination on grounds of ethnicity, lookism is discrimination on how you look. And it's actually ridiculously prevalent. Believe it or not, appearance bullying is the most prevalent form of bullying in schools, much more so than others. And yet we have a lot less resources to tackle it, because it's not a protected characteristics. It's not sex. It's not race. So we have much less ways to kick back against it. And in fact, we don't even necessarily call it. So part of the point of talking about lookism is to say, look, if we can name a problem, then we can start to address it. So if you think back to Mad Men, and you think about the 1950s and the sort of overt sexism happening absolutely everywhere. So you knew damn well that that punch on the bum was not complimentary. It was actually a way of putting you down and putting you in your place. But it was presented as if it was a compliment, or as if it was nothing, or if it was a bit of banter. That's currently where lookism is, right? So you know that the, you know, when your friend calls out your pubic hair, right, that's not her being nice or funny, right? Or, you know, when you get shamed, it's a way of putting you down. It's a way of pulling rank, doing something, right? And yet we can feel uncomfortable, but instead of pushing back and calling out the person who's doing it, we feel ashamed of our bodies. So we're now at a point with sexism, right? We don't do that. People are happy to share their sexist stories on Everyday Sexism, on Twitter, on social media, because they know it's not okay. They're pushing back against the person who's done it, and they're not feeling ashamed of themselves. They're feeling damn angry that they've been catcalled or whatever. With lookism, we're nowhere near that. When you get a lookist comment...
Like, lookism hasn't had its, like, Me Too moment.
It has not.
Can I ask you a question? Like, I think about... Oh my God. Like, I think about this one kid all of the time that I grew up with, and he was bullied for his looks. And it was so painful to watch as a child. Like, it was obviously the most painful was for him and his parents. I don't know his parents. I was so young, but like, he was definitely unquestionably bullied for his looks. But I think about his parents, like, how would they have presented that to the school? And to the teachers, like, my son is bullied for his looks. You know, like, it's not a black and white thing. Like, oh, it's because he's this.
He's on the receiving end of lookism. Like, if they said that.
Yeah. You know, like, it's a very uncomfortable thing. Like, oh, my child has, it's not like, it's a very uncomfortable thing to talk about. And you can't, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But I also think that that was true.
It's not
about...
black and white.
It was difficult to talk about sexism before we named it. And it was difficult to talk about racism before we named it. And in fact, people were told, oh, it's normal. You have to put up with that. This is how it is. this is normal. You just have to put up with it. And that, and then part of the not wanting to name it is that we still have the shame on the inside instead of pushing the shame back on the people who are saying
exactly.
Right. Yeah. So part of the point of lookism is to name it and say, look, this is another form of discrimination. It really cuts deeply. It's not okay. And we shouldn't be ashamed of our bodies. We should be ashamed of saying nasty things about other people's bodies. And then we can get that switch. So often parents will say to me, yeah, but it's just normal. That happened to me. I'm like, well, so what? If your grandmother says that X happened to you, how many stories have your grandmother's got about sexism? We don't go, oh, well, you know, we should have just kept putting up with that because that was normal.
Right. It's
we
not
go
a like, passage.
Oh, my God, you didn't? You really let them say that to you? Oh, my goodness. Right, so that's what that's what we need to do with lookism and go, right, okay, yeah, we know everybody does it, we know it's everywhere, but it's not okay, and we don't want to live in a world where it is okay. And the more we get into a visual and virtual culture, the more prevalent it is and the harder it cuts. And that's why the flip comes, because the more it's an ethical ideal, the more we feel ashamed of ourselves, literally ashamed of ourselves when we're body shamed. So when it didn't matter that much, then, you know, for some people it might have done, but for others they just shrugged it off. We now live in a world where hardly anybody shrugs it off, and it's time for us to call it out as what it is, which is really important.
But do you think, I'm kind of like laughing, thinking about this concept, even like internet culture, even understanding this idea of looksism, because I'm thinking about like some of the accounts that are really popular on you know, Instagram. And I feel like the idea of the public understanding this idea, like, well, you can't call this celebrity, you know, you can't make fun of their appearance. And I'm not talking about, you know, vicious takedowns, but it's just kind of what the culture does. Like, oh, you know, insert celebrity here's like crazy lip injections, or like she's got a fat ass. Like, I can't believe she's with insert celebrity here. Like, I just feel like the world is kind of internet culture, like lives and dies off of looksism.
Yeah. And the world lived and died off sexism until very, very recently.
And that switch happened quickly. So how quickly can we instate this? How quickly can we get this done?
I don't know if it happened quickly.
I'm serious.
I think it might still be going on. I don't think we've overcome sexism.
We haven't solved sexism. Yes. And we haven't solved. Yeah. No.
But it wasn't. I don't think it felt that quick at the time, but historically speaking, sexism came fast. I mean, you know, one of the things about a virtual culture is stuff can change fast. And in terms of how we do it, I don't know, right? So we started the everyday lookism.
Well, name it when you see it is basically what you're
Nobody saying. Talks about looksism. I mean, I feel like it's kind of like, hey, it's not cool to tear women down. Like that's happening. But I feel like until Harvey Weinstein, like no one was saying, you know, I know Me Too was invented by someone else. It was coined by someone else before. I feel that if we can start talking about looksism ASAP, that would be great.
It would be amazing if in school other kids were calling other kids out and they said nasty things about appearance, just like they do when they say nasty things about race or sex. So even if sexism and racism is still prevalent, we have by no means solved it. We are more ashamed to say those things, and we are more policing of what people can say. That's a culture change. It's not about anybody not shaving their body hair. It's about how we think and speak about other people. And that's why we tried to begin it with the Everyday Lookism campaign, where we tried to do something similar to the Everyday Sexism campaign. But it's really interesting because nobody would share their lookist stories on social media. And it's because they're all deeply ashamed. So instead, we have a website where you anonymously upload. This tells you how far back we are on lookism and how deep-seated it is, right? So when people say, oh, God, Heather, how have you moved from serious global ethics to beauty? It's like, have you read the Everyday Lookism stories? This is blighting people's lives, right? There's nothing trivial about this. And that's the way I think, you know, too often it's brushed off as trivial or it's seen as so big it's everywhere. We just got to change that. We know it's not. Our kids know it's not. You talk to any young person about body image and there's hardly anybody who is not affected in one way or another by judgments about how they look or about how they feel about how they look.
And your Everyday Lookism campaign, was that just in the UK? Like, is that still up and running, that website?
So it's still up and running, but, you know, I'm a philosopher. What the hell do I know about a social media campaign? and you know, as I say, you put it out on social media. We thought people would share on Instagram or Twitter, but people didn't. And, you know, then people, you know, students would talk to me and say, God, no, I'd never want anybody to see I'd said that. And you look at some of the stories and they're, you know, they're things like, you know, some people are reporting things that happened to them 30 or 40 years ago that mean that they still hate their toes or whatever body part it is. I mean, it's really extraordinary how nasty comments about bodies can stay with people and shame them. And we do know that cosmetic surgery recipients will often report some insecurity that was brought on by, you know, comment by a family member or a peer in the playground. Of course. And often not meant, right? People forget them or they mean them right. And would you just go, no.
Well, before we wrap up on that, I just want to bring up one other thing that I've found, that there's this measurement of how bad the bad thing that was done to you. So I'm picturing somebody who wants to talk about lookism and wants to talk about how maybe they were bullied because, you know, they had a cross eye or a buck tooth or bad acne. But they're worried that then someone else will come on and say, well, you still have money and you're still of the dominant ethnicity and you're still more privileged than I am. Like, there's this comparing of privilege. So I feel like a lot of people are embarrassed to talk about lookism because it just doesn't feel as bad as some of the other types of discrimination that we talked about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think that's partly that in many cases, we haven't recognised how dominant and demanding the ideal is, right? We just haven't recognised what the switch there has been. And also, when you look at the research, the level of disfigurement or despairment or has very little to do with how one feels about something. So you can't judge from the outside. So very many people who some people might think were exceptionally disfigured actually have very good self-image and body esteem. It's very little to do with how one looks.
So
on
we
the
shouldn't
outside.
Judge if you're I'm just going to call it an ugliness, whatever your ugly thing is that you're worried about, and you want to say, I feel like I'm experiencing lookism. We're not allowed to say your ugly thing isn't that ugly. Because that just plays into the whole
problem. Well, then we're just focusing on bodies again, right? So the whole thing should be what we say, what we say and how we treat other people, not how we judge other people's looks, right? So when you go back to comparing, oh, is it that bad? You're still actually going, oh, let's pay more attention to how you look. And it's not about how you look at all. And then you say, oh, well, you know, lookism, it's just skin deep, right? We know it's not skin deep, right? That's the whole point.
You've just made that case very clearly,
right? And then you compare it to other forms of discrimination. Of course, they interact in all kinds of ways, right? Racial discrimination and lookism often have lots in common and go hand in hand in some instances. We've certainly seen lookism and sexism, the whole where we started from, all the talking about what happens to women that doesn't happen to men. It's absolutely embedded, and by ignoring one bit of it and one bit that's actually becoming more important, not like, oh well, you know, let's address lookism and let's forget about sexism and all the other forms of discrimination. Absolutely not. Let's call out discrimination as a complex nexus and let's try and address it as a complex nexus. If we pretend some bits aren't there, we end up not addressing any of it. Because one of the reasons you might think that appearance has become more important is that we have addressed some forms of sexism. So, you know, oh well, we'll just lay it on harder on another one, right? So
oh my God, I want to let you loose in the internet comments. I'm just going to be tagging you on Twitter every time. I just want you to like say all this, but like our society wants you to say it in like 160 characters. So that kind of makes it tough, doesn't it? I'll just send them to this podcast so they can listen. Cause I think it would really help, you know, for more people to say it. Heather, I'm like, I have so much to think about. It's crazy. I almost feel weird doing this. We do at the end of every interview with our guests, we do a little speed round just to get them to know them better. So now I want to ask you the questions we ask all of our guests and let's see how it goes. Cause I feel like I know your philosophy. I want to know you now. Do you remember back to when you were little with the first beauty or grooming product you first tried or remember using that you actually liked?
Yeah, my first lipstick that me and my best friend had, who's still my best friend, right, was called Pacific Prawn, and it was from a British High Street shop, and it was a really, really, really bad apricot colour. This was the 1980s, right?
Pacific Prawn I'm sorry, that is giving me the giggles. Like, who wants to look like a shrimp? I don't know. That's just like not a very glamorous color name.
But I will never forget it, right?
Lovely peach, yes. Okay, if there's one rule that you wish everyone would follow, what would it be?
Don't say nasty things about other people's bodies.
Excellent. And what's your favorite indulgent snack? And now I feel bad that I put the word indulgent in there. I should just say, what's your favorite snack?
Well, if it's indulgent, because of course I am subject to the same pressure.
I just
pressures.
Put a moral standard on snacking, didn't I?
I'm subject to the same pressure as everybody else. It's got to be ice cream, right? So.
Okay. All right. Thank you for not judging me for doing that.
I don't judge.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. It's circular logic here. What is your most played song on your favorites playlist right now?
So it's my daughter's favorite, which is ironically, You're So Vain.
Oh my God. Wow, we brought it like it's meta now. I love it. And then last, if there were to be a movie made of your life, who would narrate it?
Any Northern British actress, because there's not many Northern British people in academia. So Northern British woman.
And
actress.
You're from, where are you from?
I'm from Yorkshire.
Okay. And now, forgive my ignorance, I imagine that's in the north of England.
That's in the north of England. So Maxine Peake or any
Jess, this is when you're supposed to save me. Yeah. Jess lived there, so I like knows these things more than I do.
Yes, it's from the north of England.
This was so informative. I learned a lot, and I hope that our listeners did too. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the show. It's your reviews and feedback that help us make the podcast even better. Head over to iTunes to rate and review us or email your thoughts to info@fatmascara.com.
We also want to answer your beauty questions and hear what products you love. To share a Raise a Wand product review or to ask a beauty question, email us at info@fatmascara.
If you send it as a voice memo file, we can even share your voice on the podcast. You can also do that by leaving us a voice message. Our phone number in the United States is 646-481-8182.
Thanks so much for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.